This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is July 23rd, 1993, and this is tape 47, side 2. You were going to, we have been discussing the comparable worth plan, and you were going to discuss about two ways of saving money, cutting the pay and cutting personnel.
That's the thing I could never understand. We were going through the downturn and talking with the unions, and obviously we have a contract with the union. So if there's going to be any changes, you have to renegotiate a contract. And in talking with them, in my way of thinking, it was much better that people keep a job, even if they have to take a little bit less pay, than it would be to be fired. That's not the way the unions see it. If you have to save money, fire people. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand that. I really don't understand that at all. The only rationale, of course, I can understand is that if you lower the pay, then they are starting it from a lower plateau for the next bargaining mm-hmm. session instead of the one they were at. We had no problem with that, meaning if we were to make any restoration, we'd go back to what that pay was when the time was good and just go from there. But they just couldn't see it that way. And I said, that's awful. It's so much better to have a job. And even if it's a little less pay, you got something coming. Incidentally, that reminded me during the time when we were attracting all these industries and high tech was coming in. And again, the labor unions were on me, on two counts, because these high-tech plants are not unionized. The labor union doesn't like that. But they kept talking about, I'm reading here today, about low-paid jobs. Mm-hmm. We're doing all these high-paid jobs to low-paid jobs. And my answer was, there aren't any high-paid jobs. They're gone. At least for now, they're not there. Mm-hmm. And my answer to them was, look, my job as a governor is to create the atmosphere for jobs. Now, it's up to Oregonians to decide if they want to apply for them. And Oregonians did. They say, hey, I want a job. They don't have this esoteric thinking that some of the labor unions have. Labor unions are an interesting breed. They represent in Oregon, it's hard for me to tell right now, but less than 20% of all of the workers in the state. I don't know what it is, 18, 19, something like that. Nationally, they're about 17%, I understand, 16 or 17%. That is dues-paying organized labor, and all the rest are not. Mm-hmm. But boy, you'd think they were every single worker in the United States and in Oregon. They really make a lot of fuss.
But it's still a pretty big block, isn't it?
It's a good block, but they still don't close the block as we talked earlier. Mm-hmm. So there's the leadership, and they're making a lot of waves. It's interesting. I wouldn't ignore them or anything. My interest is in Oregon workers. It's not my job to organize them. That's up to the unions. Mm-hmm. I need to create jobs for Oregonians, and they can decide. Companies can decide, or unions can decide. That's not my job. Not my job to make it easier to unionize, or to make it tougher not to organize. I've never supported the right to work laws. That goes back, way back, in my first campaign. A lot of my conservative friends think that's the best thing to slice bread.
The right to work laws?
Yes.
Why?
Well, the right to work law says you don't have to belong to a union. That's the basic mm-hmm. concept. No one can force you to belong to a union. You could be working for a fully unionized company, and you don't have to belong to keep your job. Mm-hmm. Philosophically, that makes good sense. I just couldn't see getting in any big fight about the whole thing. Now I'm telling you what I just told you, the number of unionized who's paid to know his workers are very low. But that's their job. It's their job to organize, mm-hmm. not my job. It's not my job to make it easier for them to organize. But I cut it both ways. You know? Anyway, that's a long answer to your question. I still today can't figure out why the unions really would sacrifice workers. It would be a point of keeping that wage where it was. To me, it's so much better that somebody have a job and take home some money.
Have you ever approached them with that question?
Well, I mentioned it. They come up with the answer I told you.
Right.
They want to have a different plateau for salaries. They don't trust me or the succeeding governors to start bargaining from where they were before. But actually, that's part of the problem. You know, I said earlier that I really felt that I was for the worker all along. But you see, they come at it from a different philosophy than I do. That is that they've got their conventions and they pass resolutions and they've got a hue to that line, and some are pretty dumb, but they really don't create a good atmosphere for jobs. And being a businessman and knowing what business people yeah. react and how they react, I'm saying, look, I'm going to create jobs. I'm going to do the best I can to create jobs. Any jobs. High paying, low paying, medium paying, doesn't make any difference. We'll create them. And our unions are free to decide if they want to apply for that job or not. It was interesting. I don't know if I mentioned this. When the times were really tough and I had a fellow come in one of my open house, they were very indignant. He said, you got to do something about it. There's a lot of these Southeast Asians who are coming in. So these people are taking our jobs. You got to do something about it. And I said, well, you know, they're willing to work hard and they're willing to work for minimum pay. And the guy said to me, well, I can't work for that. You know, I've got expenses and stuff. And my answer to him was, then they're not taking your job.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't like that answer. But factually, they were. He mm-hmm. wasn't willing to do that. So how could he say they're taking my job? It's not a job he would take, even if it was offered to him. There's a lot of answers I have that isn't oftentimes applauded by the recipient.
Is it difficult as a politician to walk a line that's neither pro or anti-labor, sort of down the middle, without getting enemies on one side or the other? I have a feeling that's what you were trying to do, wasn't it? You were trying to walk a middle road without.
No, that's why I was having trouble with you.
Okay.
Your question.
All right.
This was not what I had in mind. Uh-huh. See, my approach was just exactly what I said to you. Mm-hmm. I would do everything I could to create jobs in Oregon. That was the motivation. Now, I'd made up my mind long time ago, that my job as a legislator wasn't to create jobs for union labor. That was their job. You know, I said, that's what you're supposed to do. That's not what I'm supposed to do. And so it wasn't a matter of trying to walk a line. They had their job, I had my job. And my job didn't include doing some of their job.
Right.
So
yeah
so I wasn't thinking I'm gonna walk a line between my business friends and my labor friends. And that was not, I had never even, as a matter of fact, I was curious when he asked the question, never even thought about it. I'm just out there to create jobs. Mm-hmm. And, I get just as indignant. I mentioned way back about vetoing a bill in which business was coming to try to get a legislated advantage in business. And I was upset about that. Mm-hmm. And I vetoed the bill. Because that's their job, not my job. So, you see, I was really kind of approaching it in a philosophical basis. It had nothing to do with politics. I've always felt, and it appears in all the things I've said, that I'm going to do what I think is the right thing to do. this whole idea of pressure you apply on yourself. I got to be for the unions, or I got to be against the unions. You know, when you approach things on the basis of that kind of thing, then you have an awful time.
Mm-hmm.
You're down for unions, tomorrow I'm for business, you know, it's one of those things. And, you know, people identify me, but pro-business. Well, yeah, I'm pro-business. But yet they don't seem to understand that my pro-business means somebody creating jobs. It isn't to make some one person wealthy.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm after. I always, you know, I have my own way back, beginning day one, maybe in our tape interviews. You have to be a lawyer, you know, just have a set of principles and a little common sense. And mm-hmm. that was the guide, that was my guide all the way through. I had my own philosophy, my own set of principles. And that's what I applied. And these people that try to they're voting according to I've got to be for business, or I've got to be for labor, or I've got to be for gays, or I've got to be against gays, or I've got to be for abortion, or I've got to, you know what I mean?
Right.
Where they're doing it because they think that's the political thing to do, I feel sorry for them. They have an awful time. If you apply the subject before you against this set of principles, it's so much easier.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe it isn't a political thing to do, or in my case it worked out quite well, but I was never afraid. I've gone to the Republican caucuses, and I tell them, because I hear them say things in caucuses about, well, we really ought to do this because that's where popular opinion would be. I said, well, wait a minute. No, you do the most political thing you can do. You're talking about sheer politics. Is to do what you think is right. But that was never a message I was able to get across. They just couldn't see that.
Do you feel that your message in general, or this philosophy of yours, has been understood?
No. And see, what makes it even more difficult is people begin to determine who Bigotia is.
Right.
They're doing it from a perception of what most elected people are like. And I said so many times, it's been real frustrating to me. And again, I mentioned it, I used read my lips long before George Bush did. Listen to me. What I just said is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Don't read between any lines.
Mm-hmm.
Because you read between any lines, that's not where I am. I'm on the line. But the people know, they say, no, he can't be. No, he really does mean something else, you know? Well, I can't help that. All I can be is who I am, and that's who I was.
So do you feel you've been misunderstood then?
Oh, I'm not pouting about it. Misjudged, misunderstood, yeah, but I'm not pouting about it. Remember I told you about the lowest day, I think I told you about it, when I really felt bad and then I went home at night and said, I'm not a failure, or did I tell you that story?
I can't recall, but please tell me again. It sounds very interesting.
I've been getting beat up pretty much by the business community. It really disturbed me because I knew I was doing what they really have been saying all these years they want it done. And as a matter of fact, not just business people, the folks on the street. You've got to run government like business.
This is at what point? When? What year? What time?
Oh, this would have been probably 86, before I left office, late. And I knew that I was getting criticized, and it kind of bothered me. I said, hey, but wait a minute. How come these people, these bright people, these my friends, you know, free enterprise, all the rest of them, all the things I attributed to them, how come they don't understand I'm doing this the way they want it done? And as a matter of fact, I was recounting this with Jerry Thompson last Sunday. We went down and played golf with Jerry and Al Thompson, and we were kind of talking about it. And I said, I can one time, I had brown bag with some business people. And they were just chewing me up something awful. And then later on that afternoon, I met with a bunch of labor people. And I came back to the office and said, Jerry, something's really wrong. I said, I got really beat up by my business friends. And we had, and later on this afternoon, I met with the labor people, and we had one whale of a good time. I said, something's really wrong here. Well, anyway, she had been up to Portland, and she came back, and she was delivering a pretty heavy-duty message about all this criticism. And it was really, honestly, the lowest point, psychologically, in my career. I said, God, I really felt really down, real bad. And it kind of weighed on me the rest of that afternoon, and I got home that night, and it was still heavy on my mind. And all of a sudden, I said to myself, now, wait a minute. I'm not a failure. I know I'm not a failure. Now, they don't know it, but I know it. Mm-hmm. That was the end of it. I felt better. And so when you ask me about being misunderstood, I'm satisfied in my mind that I did a job, and a good job as governor of the state of Oregon. Now, whether somebody else doesn't see it that way, you know, I sleep at night.
But is it frustrating for you?
Frustrating only in a different sense. Mm-hmm. My successor.
Neil Goldschmidt.
Yeah, Neil Goldschmidt. Ran things rather badly. And he treated the tax dollar like poker chips. It had no real meaning. And I'm making a judgment now about him. And what really frustrates me is the fact that my business friends think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And yet, he, and my way of thinking is absolutely 180 degrees away from where I was. I was doing what needed to be done. He didn't. They think he's great, and they were criticizing me. That's the frustration. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything about it. I still go back to what I said. I know I'm not a failure.
Right.
Okay. There you are. I can't change things. I can't go around knocking anybody's door, spend a half a day and tell them how great I am. I'm not going to do that. So, you just have to live with it.
Do you think that as time passes and people have a chance to look at your career, to look at your record, the things that you've done, the things that you've said, maybe even listen to these tapes and read the transcript. Do you think that they'll come to a different understanding or a more complete understanding?
It's hard to tell. You have to guess what history is going to say, mm-hmm. who's going to listen to it, who wants to write about it, who wants to think about it. Mm-hmm. I'll be very practical about it and think it's very unlikely somebody in the future is going to sit down and write a book about Victor Tia. Because my style was not that skyrocket in the air kind of mm-hmm. style, which catches the attention. Mm-hmm. Getting back to what's leadership, remember we talked about that before. Maybe someday. As I was leaving office, you know, people would say, well, you know, what do you think about your tenure? And I said, that's not a judgment I'm going to make. Going to be whoever else is going to make that appraisal in the future. It's not a judgment I can make. All I know in my heart, how I feel, and that's all I can deal with. I can't deal with it anymore. Mm-hmm. As I thought about all the times we've talked here and the questions you've asked me, sometimes I can remember a bill, sometimes I can't. When I can't, I would kind of apply a philosophy of mine and say this probably where I came down because. Mm-hmm. Or at sometimes, again in our tape interviews, people would say, well, you said such and such. And I say, I couldn't have said such and such. That's not who I am. That's not how I feel. Now, a person that was trying to be somebody else might have had some doubts in their mind. Maybe I did say that. You know, because they're always kind of vacillating. Today I'm this and tomorrow I'm something else. You can't remember everything. And but with me, it was no problem. Mm-hmm. No, I couldn't have said that. Mm-hmm. That's not who I am. So, you know, maybe I don't remember that instance, but I said, no, that's not, I couldn't have said that. That's not me. And so that's why I was kind of comfortable with being able to do, because I apply what I believe is the right principle in terms of what a democracy is all about. That's where I come from. But when you start measuring what I just told you against what you would consider a typical elected official, it just doesn't match up. You know, it just, no. He's just kind of blowing smoke into the tape here. But again, you know, if that's their reaction, that's their reaction. I can't do anything about it. All I know is who I am. That's who I am. Now, how others judge me, that's up to them. It's my intention, as we conclude this, to kind of recap some of the, what I think are significant, long-term, long-lasting things that I think happened. And I think they're important. But we'll do that as a wrap-up.
What, as you look back across not only your career and the careers of other people in politics, there's such a wide variety, and even in a state like Oregon, where the population is somewhat more homogeneous than some other places, the wide variety of people that they elect to statewide office, what do you think the people want? What are they looking for, and why is there such a large variety? Why would they vote for a Vic Atiyah 1 year and then turn to a Neil Goldschmidt the next? Or do they not know what they want?
Neil Goldschmidt was more a result of maybe the not the best campaign by Norman Collins. It was more that Norma let it slip from her fingers rather than Neil won. Now I'm talking about politics.
Mm-hmm.
We take the next step. Barbara Roberts is governor because an independent jumped in the race. Had that not happened, Dave Frumer would have been governor. So, okay, we've got some reasons for that. If we take it in a generic sense, we get to talk about the difficulty elected has, particularly in urban areas, and the fact that somebody is trying to run is trying to separate themselves from the challenger from an incumbent, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And there, if a person doesn't know, maybe he doesn't know either one, candidate for legislature,
mm-hmm.
say, well, I'm a Republican, I'll vote for him, or I'm a Democrat, I'll vote for him. So it isn't a matter of a deliberate choice. Then it becomes, that's the kind of reaction of the polls. That's
mm-hmm.
why it's hard, very hard for Republicans to take a majority, particularly in Multnomah County has a lot of senators and a lot more House members. And it's very difficult to get the message out. Last election in Clackamas County, something very unique happened. A chairman of a large and successful business decided to run for county commission. Now that's very unusual. Usually a businessman, and certainly at that stage, chairman, you know, just, I'm not going to fool around with that. I don't need that. That kind of, you know, they just
mm-hmm.
won't run.
Mm-hmm.
He decided to run. He ran against an incumbent, former legislator. Actually, one that really had never, well, certainly had never run a company, had never had to make payrolls, had never had to do all the things that you have to do to survive in the business world. Most often had been in some position that was in public funds, getting paycheck from public funds. So here we have someone running, and this now is a challenger against the incumbent Democrat. They lost. I can't believe this. What a wonderful opportunity the people of Clackamas County had to get somebody to run the government or be part of a county commission that really knew how to run things. But first of all, he was an incumbent. Second, he was a Democrat. And he campaigned good. Oftentimes, I would fault the campaign. Many people that would be business people think, oh, this is going to sign up and I'll go. You know, everybody's got to recognize I'm a good person. It doesn't work that way. But he campaigned hard. He did. And again, that was also one digit. So in fact, I just don't understand it. You asked me, you know, how come all this happens? There are reasons. By that, I mean mechanical reasons. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the governor's races. I mentioned the House races. Those kinds of things happen. Everybody's got a reason why somebody won or somebody lost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It may be the right or wrong reason. Remember I told you earlier, I don't believe in coattails except negative coattails. And some of the losses of recent races, U.S. Senate race down in Texas, this guy was trying to get away as far away from Bill Clinton as he could, but he couldn't get unstuck from him. And he lost the race. So that's what I call a negative coattail.
Mm-hmm.
Positive coattails hardly ever work. I left office saying, okay, it's been 28 years. I did what I was thinking was right. I knew from day one I was going to please everybody. I was going to be honest, vote the way I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it would have been accurate. The chips fall wherever they're going to fall. I have no ability to judge where they're going to fall. They're going to fall. Well, maybe people listen to it. And say, well, God, maybe I see the IT in a different light. But they still won't take, I know enough about history. You know, okay, that's fixed version. You know, but this is what really happened. And that's probably the right way to treat history. Yeah. The fact that I said it, the one thing I hope they would not do is dispute I did what I thought was right. That I did it against a backdrop of a personal philosophy. Hope they would misjudge that. But they may say, no, that's not the way it really happened. This is the way it happened, you know. Okay, that's appropriate. It's not inappropriate. And I would expect it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Can't, you know, if I wrote an autobiography, you know, autobiographies are never taken with gospel.
People presume that there's a bias.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they, I think, properly approached. I have no problem.
You don't think you'll write a autobiography?
Oh, I don't think so. First of all, I'm not a very good writer. And I don't know who'd buy it. My family might. My close friends would. But that, you know, when you get past that one, that'd be hardly worth the printing. So.
at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is July 15th, 1993. And this is tape 47, side one. You also announced at this point that there was a $71.4 million